You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 439. Anytime a film scores a massive hit or gets uniform critical acclaim, it's a surprise. When a film does both, it's a miracle. Jeffrey Katzenberg.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's film, B-I-Z, book.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Now, guys, we've all heard these stories of difficult and even dangerous film shoots from Apocalypse Now, Francis Ford Coppola, and, you know, The Abyss with James Cameron. And we've all heard of these kind of epic and mythical stories, but generally we don't hear about them in independent films. So when I heard this story, I had to bring the filmmaker onto the show. So today's guest is filmmaker Jan Gustafsson, who directed the documentary film Wrath of Gods, which documents one of the most dangerous and difficult film shoots in modern history, and definitely in modern independent film history. Now, Jan wasn't only a documentarian, he was also cast in the film, which was called Beowulf and Grendel, and also starred Gerald Butler right before he blew up when he did 300. Now, the filmmakers anticipated the usual complications involving making a major motion picture, but what they didn't plan for was the ruthless Icelandic winter on the foreboding landscape, financial complications, and a bizarre run of bad luck that led them all to believe that they were cursed and they were in an epic battle with Norse gods themselves. And Jan was there the entire time for the insane, insane ride. I mean, the crew was battling hurricane force winds while the producers were trying to shore up a collapsed financial deal, and so many other crazy things that happened, from the set burning down to a leaky Viking boat that if they fell into the water, they would die within 2 minutes. It was an insane, insane story, and all captured in the documentary Wrath of Gods, which is going to be part of Indie Film Hustle TV. And I will put links in the show notes on where you can watch this insane documentary. If you're a filmmaker, you need to watch this film. So without any further ado, let's get into the weeds with filmmaker Jan Gustafsson. I'd like to welcome to the show Jan Gustafsson. How are you doing, Jan?
I'm very good. Thank you. How are you?
Oh, thank you, my friend. Thank you for being on the show. You are in coming from us from Iceland, probably one of the more safer places in the world to be right now regarding COVID.
Absolutely, and about to get even more safe, because there's some big news happening here with COVID in Iceland, and we have like on every given day we have like between zero and maybe five positive people.
Stop it! I live in Los Angeles. Please stop it.
I know. But we are an island in the North Atlantic, almost by the Arctic Circle. We have a population of 350,000 people. Jeez. We have one international airport. So we can actually, and they have put in restrictions. Everybody who lands in Iceland now is forced to have a test at the airport, right, and then quarantine for 5 days and then be tested again. So we catch them, you know.
Well, I envy you, sir, in many, many ways. So, but we're here to talk about film, talk shop. So before we get started, how did you get into the ridiculous film business?
It's a bit of a long story that I'll just try to compress a little bit. My first love was music. I was never really that good as a musician. I ended up in studios producing, recording, and then in high school, basically, my a friend of mine had a radio show, and I figured, you know, hey, maybe he can get me a job on a radio show on national radio. So I ended up getting a weekly show playing 1 hour a week of music. So I fell in love with radio and I decided this could be a career. And I went to the BBC in London and studied radio production. And I came back and there were no jobs for me in radio. So I figured television might be similar, you know, similar elements to work with. So I went to the TV station and there was a crazy guy who had taken over the programs department. And he was an old film director who used to do Viking movies. And he saw me walk in and he gave me a job on the spot. So suddenly I had a job in television, and he actually gave me my own show. It's just a sort of weird situation. And so I had my own television show for about 2 years. Nice. And then I figured, hey, you know, this is an interesting place to work, but I don't want to be in front of the camera. I want to be on the other side. So I started looking for a place to study television production, and I found a school in Manchester, England. So, and I because I had worked in television, they let me into the second year. So I missed the first year. Beginning of second year was a class where they sat us down and said, now we're going to do a short film. Go home and write a script and bring it back. And then we'll pick some scripts and we'll shoot them. And that it was just an eye-opening thing for me. Like suddenly a whole new world opened up. So I finished my bachelor's at Manchester Polytechnic and soon realized they didn't know anything about filmmaking. This sort of world of filmmaking that was opening up for me. I was already like, you know, 25 or 26. But so this world of filmmaking opened up. But the guy who was the head of the film school, he said in one of our first classes, he said, now you're film students, you should see yourselves as filmmakers. So, you know, don't be afraid to walk around like this.
And you're holding up a... I'm assuming I know this, but I don't know. Okay, so people listening, he's holding up, he's putting his hands together and not the standard, like, you know, letterbox or the shot of like, you know, framing your shot with, you know, those famous director shots where you see them holding up their hands, trying to frame it with their fingers. He's holding up a drop. Some sort of drop. I don't even know what that is. So that says a lot about the teacher, I guess.
Well, the nicest guy you could find, you know, so supportive, so encouraging. But I found out his background was from the pottery department. He was a pottery teacher, so that would explain the
the pot, this. the pot look. Jesus Christ! So you're starting off with a bang, okay?
Yeah, but you know, I actually it was great class. Made one of my best friend from that class. It was a small class, but she ended up making a film that was distributed by Miramax all over the world and so on. So you know, it was not completely hopeless, but I realized these people could not teach me filmmaking, and I was spent 2 years in Manchester, and it was raining the whole time. It was raining and cloudy, foggy, and I figured I'm going to continue down this path, but I'm going to do it where the sun shines, you know. So I applied for some schools in LA. Applied to like three schools, and got into one called CalArts, California Institute mm-hmm. of the Arts. Mm-hmm. And got into a master program there for directing theater and cinema with actually an amazing teacher called Alexander McKendrick, who was one of the Ealing Studios sort of golden years directors. He directed the Lady Killers, the original Lady Killers.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
And another one called Man in the White Suit, which was an Ealing comedy. He made Whiskey Galore.
Very cool. Which has,
you know, The Lady Killers, probably the you know, most famous one. And then he moved to the States and did Sweet Smell of Success with Tony Curtis and Burt Lancaster.
Wow. So he was a heavy hitter of his day.
He was very much, and then he pretty much got ruined by Lancaster. Lancaster ruined his career.
Wow!
And so he ended up teaching. He had emphysema and he smoked too much all his life.
Sure.
So. He would drive his buggy around school and teach us directing, and so it was like old school filmmaking, film language, pretty much the way they would shoot films at Ealing Studios.
Got it. So it was an old style of filmmaking, like, you know, more studio style kind of filmmaking, which then leads me to one of the main reasons I got you on the show is because of your film, Beowulf and Grendel, which is, I'm just curious how that whole studio mentality worked on Beowulf and Grendel. I don't think it was very, very similar. Or how did that work out? Well, first of all, tell us about Beowulf and Grendel, how you got involved with the project, and then we'll go into the misadventures, let's call them, of the making of it.
Beowulf and Grendel was directed by one of my best friends, a guy called Sturla Gunnarsson. He's one of the leading sort of directors in Canada. Mm-hmm. He was born in Iceland, grew up in Canada, and it was his dream project. He had been making movies for a while, and he was he's an Oscar nominated director, mm-hmm. and he wanted to make this big film in Iceland. Beowulf, story of Beowulf and Grendel. He wanted to shoot it in this sort of primal landscape of Iceland. And so he called me one day and asked, he had a list of actors, and he just wanted to, like, you know, run them by me. What do you think about, you know, there were kind of big names of young guys, but none of them seemed to fit. But the last name was Gerard Butler, was pretty much unknown back then. And he said, so, you know, have you heard of this guy? And as it happened, like about 5 days earlier, my friend from Manchester had called me and said, I just finished a film with Gerard Butler and Emily Mortimer, and it's going to be playing at Tribeca, and Miramax is giving us a limo, 24-hour limo, like for the whole duration, you know, come down and party with us for the Tribeca Festival. And so I knew I was going to be hanging out with him, so I told Stirla to come down to Toronto with me. And so we met up with Jerry, and Stirla ended up casting him for the film. So Stirla basically asked me to come along and shoot sort of behind-the-scenes stuff, to do a website for the film. It was probably the first time a film was being promoted as it was being shot, at least a film of that level. So I would be like interviewing Jerry, taking pictures, interviewing different people, putting it on the web as little web videos, little behind the scenes things. And with no money, just a little tiny little Sony mini DV camera. Mm-hmm. He gave me a little mini DV camera and gave me a box of tapes. So in order to, justify having me there the whole time, he cast me as Beowulf's warrior number two. Beowulf, played by Jerry, had an army of 10 people. And some of them had names. Mm-hmm. And then there was Beowulf's warrior number one, Beowulf's warrior number two.
Right.
So I was just completely at the bottom of that list of 10 warriors, pretty much. There was some interesting guys in that team. One of them ended up on Game of Thrones, playing the Hound on Game of Thrones, for example. And so I was there in Viking costume for 40 shooting days. So I basically lived in these remote country hotels and guest houses, and 40 shooting days in chainmail, all this sort of leather stuff, helmets. I had my own sword and some other weapons.
So then he hired you basically to do a documentary or like behind the scenes, or did you were you just there to kind of document things? And then you're like, wait a minute, there's a documentary here. Let me do a little bit more with it.
It's right from the start, things started going wrong. We were supposed to start shooting at the end of July. And because of financing, because of the British co-producers mostly, they didn't put in their money, the shooting got delayed. Everything got delayed into the fall. So this, from very early on, this became a story of things going wrong. So when they've built a set on top of a mountain on the south coast of Iceland, with the open North Atlantic right there in front of you. And then you get delayed into the fall. You're into the storm season, you know, those big storms that come up the east coast of the U.S. and they spin up basically across the Atlantic. So we have a lot of those, because some of those storms and hurricanes hit the east coast. Some of them are just out at sea, but they all end up in Iceland. So we have a very stormy season, fall season. So things went wrong right from the start.
And then, because from your movie Wrath of God, it is arguably one of the most difficult sets and difficult productions I've ever seen. Going through documentary. I mean, I saw the documentary of The Abyss with James Cameron, which arguably was one of the toughest, obviously Apocalypse Now, Hearts of Darkness. obviously that's a very difficult one, but this is up there as one of the more difficult ones, because it just seemed like you were just getting not only pounded, but you were getting pounded from multiple directions and nothing seemed to be going right. Can you tell me about the Viking blessing? Because apparently it might have been a blessing or a curse, depending on how you look at it.
The composer for the film Babel and Grendel is an incredibly good composer. He's also the head pagan priest of Iceland, of the pagan religion. Mm-hmm. So Sturla got him to come on, you know, the night before the first shooting day and perform this ritual, a pagan blessing. And so he's doing his ceremony there, and we don't understand a word he's saying, but the whole crew, you know, we have like, you know, Gerard Butler, we have Stellan Skarsgård from Sweden, and you know, all these big actors and stuff, people around. And then after the ceremony, Sturla, the director, he falls and hits his head on the rocks and on this beach where we were. It's a rocky beach, and is almost knocked out. And the sound that went through the crew was like a sound of terror, because we realized we may have just jinxed the production.
So you guys already, that was already a bad omen, that the director almost knocked himself out and almost killed himself at the beginning when the blessing was happening. So this was already a bad scenario walking in.
Now, yes, but as you will see in this, in the documentary Wrath of Gods, we were already almost canceled a few times. Everybody we sent home a few times because they couldn't pay the salaries, because the funding was not in.
But that's the old, like, I mean, I wrote a whole book about my adventures trying to make a $20 million movie with the mob. And it was similar. It was like the financing would, like, we got enough just to pay the crew and keep the crew happy for another 2 or 3 weeks. And then we got to find more money and before the real money drops. And it was just this constantly chasing money. But you have, you know, you have people in another country and you've got sets built and weather is coming and you got issues with all that. The financing just never, you were always behind the eight ball, essentially, with financing, correct?
The production was the, you know, I'm spoiling the documentary completely. The production wasn't financed until 2 weeks after the shoot ended.
Oh, wow. So then how did you guys keep going?
That's, you know, Telefilm Canada put in a few million, mm-hmm. and they decided to trust the process. The Icelandic Film Fund put in like $1 million, and they were just told that everything was fine. They were just told that, hey, you know,
it's all going good. It's fine.
Everybody's paid up. It's all good. And they decided to trust the process.
Wow.
And paid out the money. So they managed to keep it going and managed to bring Jerry over and, you know, start shooting. And all the time afraid that the crew would just disappear, because if the crew doesn't get paid, like why would they stick around?
Right. This is not like crew not getting paid in Los Angeles. Sunny Los Angeles, where they might be able to hang out for a couple of days. They're literally in battle with nature, yep, at this point in the game. I mean, you're, yep, getting hurricane storms hitting you. I mean, well, tell me, is it true? Because I saw this, and I have to ask you: is it true that if a crew member would have fallen, or an actor would have fallen into the water where you guys were shooting, that they had about 3 to 5 minutes before they die?
Yeah. They rented a Viking ship replica, like the only real Viking ship replica, or like, you know, full size Viking ship replica that is in Iceland. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to put it on what's called the Glacier Lagoon, which is like the coldest water in the world. It's a lagoon where a glacier is melting, and you have these pieces of glacier breaking off and floating through this rather big lagoon. And when they finally got the Viking ship to the lagoon and put it in, it turned out it leaked like a sieve, because the boat had not been prepped. It had been standing on dry land for a few years, and there was no money to pay the owner to prep it.
To seal it and make sure everything was fine. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, you know, you need to put it in the water. The wood needs to expand and all the cracks to close and all of this. So this was never done. So once they put the ship in the water, it started sinking. So they managed to make it float by putting in a lot of pumps. So we would sail with a full sail and everything through this glacier lagoon between the icebergs with Jerry and the army, 10 of us on the boat.
Uh-huh.
And they would shout, you know, cut the pumps. We'd turn off the pumps, roll the camera, and we would row as long as we could, but the water was rising in the boat. And when the captain said, that's it, they would cut the camera and we would start the pumps.
So you mean to tell me that you have your entire main cast, Gerald Butler is one of them. He wasn't a big movie star then yet, but you have Gerald Butler, you have you and all the other cast with one of the main, I'm assuming one of the main set pieces of the movie, which is this big boat in the coldest water in the world. And you decided, or the director decided, you know what, we're going to go out with pumps and we'll pump out the water as we go. Now, if the pumps would have broken, the ship would have sank, and they really would have been a big problem. Is that correct?
Well, you know, luckily we didn't find out, but but the guy who was like head of security for the lagoon said, if you fall in, life expectancy is between 3 and 5 minutes. So just wait for the rescue guys to come and pick you up. And it is, you know, incredibly cold, but you have to trust that they had, you know, a way to get us back to shore and all of this. But if everybody had gone down at the same time, like, you know, who would they save first?
Exactly. So this is insanity. This is the definition of filmmaking insanity. Cause I mean, you can see Terry Gilliam in Lost in La Mancha, and you can see these, there's so many stories of crazy directors doing crazy things to tell their story. And that's fine. I'm not saying your director was crazy, but this is a bit insane. I mean, obviously you had safety. It wasn't just like you went out with a bunch of, you know, this wasn't an independent film with a bunch of people. Let's go and risk our lives. You had safety crew around and, you know, but if something would have really gone wrong, there might've not been the depth to help everybody at the same time.
I know I was not first on the list.
No, you were obviously, what was it, henchman 10, 2, number 2?
Beowulf's warrior number 2.
Beowulf and the warrior number 2. You weren't even Beowulf warrior number 1. You were number 2.
Number 2.
So,
I was hiding this little Sony video camera.
Right, you're shooting during this.
Behind my shield.
Right.
Or behind a cape. I had like this sort of cape sometimes, or like a thingy over my shoulder. So I would always carry this little Sony camera with me.
So you were filming the documentary while you were acting in the movie. So like between takes, or between while they were pumping the water out or something, you would start shooting behind the scenes. You would do some on the set interviews. Cause I saw there's a lot of on the set interviews with Jared Butler and other cast members and things like that. Yeah. That's insane. I mean, talk about a real true documentarian. You're in it.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is that, I mean, I had never really worked on a big set like this. And I'd done some documentaries before for television, smaller stuff. But I was watching my friend go through hell.
Right.
The guy who gave me his camera, and he gave me a box of 50 tapes and said, just film stuff. Just, you know, grab stuff.
Right.
And I was watching him basically go through hell, the director of this movie.
Right.
And watching him, you know, I thought he was losing his mind. You know, imagine being faced with this dilemma. Do I just cancel now and send everybody home? Or do we go on that leaky Viking ship and try our best
to tell a story?
Yeah.
Now, so if it was, and then there were at times hurricane force storms that hit you guys while you were on location, correct?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Yes, I remember waking up or getting up after a sleepless night, and coming out to the breakfast and being told the set disappeared. So the whole set got blown out to sea, and because they had built a set down by the seaside, somewhere closer to the sea, and everything was just gone. And it's in the documentary. Yeah. I went down there with the first car, and there's like crew picking up stuff somewhere way far in the distance and trying to drag it back.
My God!
All the dining facilities and all the porta potties, and it was like an explosion happened, and it was a disaster scene.
I just, as you're telling, because I've seen the documentary, so I've seen pieces, I've seen this stuff. It's remarkable to think that, you know, the strength that you need as a human being, as a filmmaker, to lead all of these people into war, because it's this, you're battling the elements, you're battling financing, you're battling all of this stuff, is pretty remarkable. It really is.
It's absolutely incredible. And you see, another day we lost 8 cars because of flying rocks. The wind was so strong that it was picking up rocks and smashing windshields and so on. And when your front windshield or back window or whatever is smashed out, you cannot use that car in a winter storm.
Right.
You just put it away. So 8 cars. We lost 8 cars in one day. And I was sitting in one of them with a producer rolling the camera, filming the producer and the director arguing or having a heated discussion. Mm-hmm. Producer wanted to send everybody home off the mountain. The director wanted to keep them there in case the wind went down and we could shoot something. Mm-hmm. And then this rock comes flying and smashes the rear window of the SUV we are sitting in, and I got it all on camera. And that was the moment when I realized I have a documentary. I have a story. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, catching enough stuff. When that happened, I figured this could be a standalone documentary. So this was supposed to be like, you know, what do you call it? Like
behind the scenes. Yeah, behind the scenes,
additional footage, this sort of bonus material. It was called bonus material on a DVD, you know, because that you would have the movie and then you would have bonus material.
Sure.
And that's what I was supposed to be doing. And at this point, I realized I have my own story. So But the interesting thing is, everybody, almost everybody, I'm just gonna lie and say everybody, because it's not true about absolutely everybody, mm-hmm. but almost everybody refused to leave. They just said, we have to get through this. This was such a challenge. And the biggest challenge was not the British co-producers who refused to send us money. It was the elements, the storms. And I don't know, have you been out in a big storm? Out on a mountaintop in a big storm? It's fascinating, because you have this the power of nature that you are fighting, and it makes you stronger.
Well, I mean, like a sword becomes stronger the more it is bent and beaten and heated and bent and and that's how a sword becomes stronger, as you continue to fold it and beat it and heat it and fold. Yeah. And that's, as filmmakers, that's what happens to us every time we're in a production. We're getting beaten, we're getting folded, and we're getting stronger and stronger. That's why when you know, I've had the pleasure of interviewing some very accomplished filmmakers who are samurai swords, who are like the ultimate samurai swords because of the battles that they've gone through. And then I've also talked to, you know, the film student who has no idea what's coming to them. And that's what I try to do with this show and with everything I do, is try to warn everybody, it's not a matter if you're going to get hit in the face. Everyone gets hit in the face. I don't care who you are. It's about keeping going and preparing for the hit, but you're going to get hit. There's no way that you're not. Every filmmaker ever, every artist ever gets slapped, hits hit. That's life. But you guys were, man, you guys were, you were, I think it was the entire UFC was coming in and beating the heck out of you guys at the same time. Now, is it true also that, because it's not enough that you had hurricane winds, a leaky boat that can, you know, water that can kill you. The set caught on fire as well, didn't it?
Because they had like, it's a Viking longhouse, and there's everybody's supposed to sit around the fire. So, of course, they had some propane gas, you know, stuff going on underneath. Right. And one day, like this was towards the end when I don't know, imagine somebody who's been beaten down and just rises up again like their spring, like, you know, on a spring. We were all like that. So when the set caught on fire and these guys come just running and screaming, everybody out, there's this fire, like, Jerry walked like calmly out, and Stellan Skarsgård walked calmly out and just lit a cigarette and said, "You're really getting your stuff, Jon, aren't you?"
This is really good for the documentary, isn't it?
Excellent stuff for the documentary. and it became like sort of the documentary became, in a way, something that kept us together a little bit, because we wanted this story told, and especially Jerry at the end wanted to this story of this madness told, everything we went through. And let me tell you, he was not a huge star by then, but it was very obvious he was going places. And that's, it comes out in the character. Somebody who's willing to do this, willing to suffer this much for what he's doing. And I never heard him complain. Like not complain, you know, we'd all say, you know, we'd all curse the weather and the conditions, but he never showed anything other than determination. And it was so obvious, this guy is going to survive. This guy is going to go places.
I don't remember we're hearing it, but when did he find out that he got 300? Because
It was right after. It was you never know the actual the other side, but I know that they were looking at our website. They were looking at our photos and our videos and stuff that was coming out of our set. And it became very obvious very early on that Jerry was material for a, you know, a hero. Mm-hmm. Before that, he had done like Phantom of the Opera.
Right.
And it went nowhere, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Because it was supposed to give him this recognition, but, you know, then you end up with a guy with a mask covering his face. And, you know, how do you – you don't get any face recognition out of that.
Right.
So that didn't work, but it became very obvious as he put on the chainmail and the sword and the helmet. And we were riding a lot of horses. I had to do like horse riding training for 3 weeks to just to be in the army. Mm-hmm. And he did as well. And he was so good at it. And he showed that hero character, that warrior character. And so 300 was a logical next step.
And so if it wasn't for Beowulf, we might have not had a Gerald Butler Leonidas.
I'm just gonna choose to believe that. I'm sure there were agents and managers and whatever who said
No, of course, but look, I've lived in this town for a while and I know how this town works, and that they go, oh, look, he looks like if he would have just had Phantom of the Opera, it would have been a tougher sell. But having those images, that footage, that thing, he looks, I mean, you look at him in Beowulf, it's not that big of a leap over to 300. It's not exactly. At all. It's that's, not at all. And that's what Hollywood loves. Hollywood likes it. Okay, that makes sense. He looks great. So it was basically a giant casting video for Jerry.
I think it paid off for him, you know.
He did. He's done okay.
But you see, if you look at it, how many male actors of that age, mm-hmm, with the charisma, have what it takes to play King Leonidas?
No, there wasn't many. And there was a lot of them were part of the 300 that might have been able to play that part. But the gravitas that Jerry brought, and then also the ability to do that workout. I mean, that says a lot. The working out that those guys did was ridiculous to get to that shape. So there wasn't many at that time. There really wasn't. And he was a special guy.
Because, like, you know, you're gonna edit me out for being politically wrong, mm-hmm, but and insulting. But a lot of the other actors in a similar place at the time were not that manly.
I agree. I agree with you. No, that's not. I won't edit you out. No, I understand what you're saying. But
so he was able to show a manliness that justified him being Beowulf. He became Beowulf.
Yeah, he has the testosterone level, without question, Jerry. And that's not something that he tries to do. He just has it. There's actors who have that, you know, from Stallone to Schwarzenegger, you know, to those, you know, the classics like those guys. They just have it naturally. And then you see other actors who will remain nameless who try to act it, but you can tell that they're really not. Jerry's one of those guys that has it. No question about it.
You know, like Crow has it.
Russell. Yeah.
So there are a few, and he was one of them.
Yeah, no question about it. Now,
I'm not saying he was the best actor in the world back then, mm-hmm, but he had what it took.
He was the best for that part. And yeah. I think, and he was the best for Beowulf at that moment in time. He did what he was a good match, not just in front of the camera, but also behind the camera and having the gusto to continue to move forward when obviously the gods were not with you. on this shoot in many ways.
Oh, there were days when we were on, I remember the scene, Jerry and his army, we all walk up this hill to the top of a hill, and Stellan Skarsgård comes running out of the Viking longhouse, the meat hall, and we all meet at the top of this hill. And a gust of wind so strong came along and moved everybody about 2 feet to the side. Like the wind picked up everybody and just threw us 2 feet. And everybody just kept going with the scene.
Because, I mean, I've been on a lot of productions where crew sometimes doesn't want to move forward in the tough situations, or actors might not want to move forward. And if in a situation like you guys were in, if you would have had a lot of dissension in the ranks, it would have not flown. If you would have, if Jerry would have been a prima donna and said, "I don't want to do this. It's too cold. It's done." You can't move forward. The whole production shuts down.
Well, this is exactly it. Jerry was the opposite of that. He was opposite of a prima donna. He was one of the main elements in driving this forward and making this happen by never complaining. You know, Stellan Skarsgård, you probably know who Stellan is.
He
was another one of those guys. He, like, cool as a cucumber through the whole thing. And, you know, the toughest, most difficult things he's been through, not necessarily, but one of them. And nobody complained. The incredible crew and the stunt master, a British guy called Peter Pedrero. Mm-hmm. He was very worried about the whole situation. He's done, like, you know, stunts for all the big British movies. Mm-hmm. And he was quite worried when we were on top of the mountain in a storm, but we've stayed friends since. And he, for at least many years after, he always had a DVD of my documentary in his bag. Mm-hmm. So on these big movies, you know, whatever they're shooting, James Bond or Harry Potter or whatever, he told me this once. He said, you know, at every production gets to a critical point where people are getting tired and they want to go home and they're about to give up and they're complaining like crazy. That's when I have a beer night. I bring my whole crew and anybody who wants to come with me, and I play them Wrath of Gods. And I say, "You think you guys got it tough? Take a look at this documentary." Mm-hmm. And it always fixed his morale.
They're like, I know we might have a tough shoot, but nothing compared to that. Let's go out there and finish this movie, guys. Now, I have to ask you, would you do it again?
Yes, of course.
That's the insanity of filmmakers. We're insane.
Yeah, and you know, and I do all the time. You know, I decided to live in Iceland. You know, could have lived anywhere, but no, this is it's one of those things. You know, if you make it through, mm-hmm. I would do it again in a heartbeat. It was crazy madness and fantastic people. You know, on this production, for example, because we got delayed for about 3 weeks, Stellan had arrived in Iceland and then we got delayed. So for 3 weeks, roughly, we had nothing to do except sit in this mountain hotel, eat, drink, smoke, and tell stories. So every night in this one room, usually Stellan telling stories. Mm-hmm. Usually Stellan telling stories about Lars von Trier, mm-hmm. his brother. You know, he calls him his brother.
Yeah.
And you know, enormous camaraderie. And then when you go through this hardship together, it creates a little bit of a bond, and nobody wanted to leave because nobody wanted to be the guy who left, you know, the guy who gave up.
Exactly. Here in the States, we have I don't know if you, I'm assuming you know who the Navy SEALs are, And yeah. it's like one of the most tough trainings in the world to be a Navy SEAL. And there's that bell. And during their training, if you quit, you have to hit the bell on the way out. And nobody wanted to hit the bell on Beowulf.
Right.
Now, what?
But mind you, with the documentary, I couldn't tell the whole story in the documentary. Mm-hmm. There were things that happened that I couldn't put into the film because at the time they would have ruined people's careers. Because there were times when we basically reached some sort of point of madness. Mm-hmm. And I remember this one night party until 5 or 6 in the morning in this country hotel, Friday night, everybody getting drunk and everybody on whatever mushrooms or whatever they could find. And these two Canadian guys come to me and they're very high or somewhere out there. And I said to them, like, stupidly, hey, guys, you can still make it to Reykjavik in 2 hours and get there before closing time if you hurry. And I shouldn't have said that because they stole a Land Rover.
Oh, my God.
And started driving at high speeds. The police found them in a field. The Land Rover had exploded over this farmer's field.
Oh, my God.
And the vehicle, I mean, Land Rover is a tough vehicle, but it was in pieces spread all over the place. Both guys lived. They survived. They were bruised and battered, but they probably survived because they were so drunk and
loose and stuff, right?
Yeah. I couldn't put this into the documentary because these were friends of mine and sure. they would have exposed something that we didn't want to expose.
Of course.
I don't think the same night, but a similar night, a British stuntman decided to walk these, it's like 3 miles from the hotel where we were living and partying to the place where he was living. And he started walking on this black country road with no lighting, you know, wearing black clothes, walking like a black sand. Another guy from a different department, equally drunk, decided to steal one of the grip trucks to drive home because he didn't want to walk. And he hit the stuntman, and that was like a career-ending injury. And these things I couldn't put in there.
Of course not. No, of course, you'd ruin people's careers. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, talk about a curse. Jesus.
There's a hint at the end of it, like where Jerry says, we've been through so much on this film. We've had like, you know, tons of injuries and car crashes and stuff. But I didn't want to explain or include that. Because mm-hmm. these were all friends of mine.
Well, everybody listening can watch Wrath of Gods on Indie Film Hustle TV, which I'm so glad I make it part of our streaming service because I'm proud to have it. It is going to be, I know, a best, very, very popular, very, very popular on the platform. So I do appreciate you putting it on our little platform. I appreciate it, man. Now I wanted to ask you before you go.
I hope so. It did really well on DVD back then. Mm-hmm. Because Jerry kind of exploded, became sure. a huge star. And so it sold a lot on DVD.
Great.
But those times are over.
Yes, the DVD days are definitely over, but it's still valuable.
I'm actually very proud of the documentary, and there's a little group of documentaries, like you said, Hearts of Darkness, Burden of Dreams. Have you seen that?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, the Werner
Herzog.
Yeah,
and I met Les Blank who did that documentary. He went with Herzog to the Amazon forest. Met him in Toronto once, and I ended up having a drink with him. And we were talking war stories, and I asked him, did you ever feel like quitting and going home and giving up on this? And he said, yeah, you know, when the natives were coming over the hill and they were shooting at us with arrows, I think it was day one.
I mean, you have to laugh because it's so insane. But I think that this movie, this documentary definitely is up in that echelon. Now can you tell me a little bit about your new film, Shadowtown?
Shadowtown is a low budget Icelandic film done in English. Again, a Canada Iceland co-production. It takes place in Reykjavik. I stupidly decided to film during the darkest time of the year, November, December, where we have 3 or 4 hours of half daylight. It doesn't even get bright, the light meter would go lift up a little bit and then fall back down. But I ended up with a British Welsh actor called John Rhys-Davies, who was in Lord of the Rings. In one of the sort of most important roles, a small role, but
Indiana Jones as well. Yeah,
he was in all the Indiana Jones movies, and which was the only place I'd seen him. I've never seen Lord of the Rings, but first time I met him, we had lunch when he came to Iceland, and he's walking towards me, and I'm like, 6 feet something, and he walks toward. had a big beard at the time when we were shooting, and he walks toward me and says, "My God, you look like a Viking." So I told him, well, actually, I played a Viking once for 40 days and I had my own sword. And the worst thing, the hardest thing I've ever had to do was to return my sword to the props or to the weapons department because the sword became a part of me. So maybe I was connecting with my Viking heritage. And he just looked straight at me and said, "Well, Viggo slept with his sword."
And there you go. Now, what are you up to next? What other projects you got?
The one that I'm trying to finance now is called Drama Club. When I graduated from directing in California, I came back and I thought I was going to start getting work as a theater director. And the only job I got was to direct an amateur theater group in a small town, isolated town. And I went there, and from day one, it was a disaster because the three best actors in the whole group had to leave because they were all farmers, and the lamb bearing season started the night before. So I ended up with three car mechanics who couldn't act and that sort of thing. So it's a story of a young director who gets that job to direct an amateur theater group.
Okay.
So I'm hoping to do that this summer. I've started the financing process for that. And if I don't get the financing this year, I have one of those micro budget projects going that I one of the reasons I started listening to your podcast is that approach, the tiny crew.
Yep.
I mean, I was actually a volunteer at Sundance when Robert Rodriguez showed up with El Mariachi.
Oh, wow. That must have been amazing.
So I knew him and his girlfriend and his two lead actors for 5 days. Always had lunch together for 5 days in a row. And then on day six, he didn't show up. And I was sitting there with his two actors, and they said, where is Robert? Mm-hmm. What happened? And he had been just whisked away into stardom. He was signing deals somewhere and so on. So I've always loved that approach. So I have this small project ready that I want to do with, one camera, one sound, two actors. Mm-hmm. And it's a story about two people, two young people stuck in Iceland and for 3 days and 3 nights, and both their lives have changed at the end of it. And it's a story about why we're never happy with what's right in front of us. Why we always think there's something better. The grass is greener on the other side of the fence.
Mm-hmm. It is an illness that we, filmmakers specifically have, but most people have as well. The grass is greener.
I think it's a human condition. I need two young actors to smuggle them into Iceland during this COVID times, and then we can just isolate ourselves and shoot this film.
That's the way to do it. My last two features were done like that, and I can't tell you how freeing it is. It's so fun, and it's a really wonderful creative process. So if you need any assistance, you let me know. I'll be more than happy to help you. And I'm going to ask you a few questions.
I've seen at least one of them.
Yeah,
and it's fun.
Yeah,
and I find this so fascinating to do it this way. I mean, this is how I do documentaries, and I want to do it exactly like you do it, except I want to meet the actors before I start shooting.
You know what? I'm going to say you should meet actors before you start shooting, and don't just meet them on day one of the shoot. Generally not the best way of going about it, but
I have to. I've directed a lot of theater. I love spending 2 months with actors just chewing on the line.
Absolutely. Know. But unfortunately, I had 4 days to shoot an entire movie at Sundance. So, you know, and that's a whole other story. But
respect to you, man.
I appreciate that. Respect to you too, my friend. Trust me, after seeing that documentary, much respect. Now I'm going to ask you a last few questions I ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Don't.
Run away.
Run away. but you know, I've realized it helps to study acting.
Mm-hmm.
And it really helps to be your own actor or marry an actor, you know, because getting a relationship, we could name a we could have a list of actors who have done it this way, acted in their own films, and because they have the charisma to do it. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to be a director, the best thing is read as much as you can and study acting, become an actor, join a theater group or start doing scene work with other actors. Understand what an actor goes through, understand what it takes to make a scene work. This is because anybody can learn, you know, the equipment and stuff. And this is what makes you a much more interesting director and filmmaker.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
It's basically, you know, not being too hard on myself. It's actually what you know, John Rhys Davies said when I was saying goodbye to him, because I was kind of devastated because I didn't get enough days to shoot, and I was missing this, I was missing that, I was so much more that I wanted to do, and he said, listen, nobody's going to be as critical of your film as yourself, so give yourself a break.
Good advice. And 3 of your favorite films of all time.
This is a horrible question.
It's horrible. I love asking it.
Because can I say like all Coen Brother films? And
sure. Okay, so that's one. All Coen Brother films. That's one. Okay. Number 2?
Oh, bloody. I only have 2 left because I have such a long list.
To be fair, I gave you like 30 movies in the first one. So that's, I mean...
I'm gonna say Sweet Smell of Success.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's an amazing film, and if you watch Mank on Netflix,
mm-hmm.
they studied Sweet Smell of Success before they shot Mank. It's an incredible film, and The last one is called Three Colors Blue by Krzysztof Kieslowski.
Oh no, Kieslowski, of course. I love all of them, but I think Red was my favorite. I loved, absolutely loved Red.
I went to see Blue with a friend of mine.
Yeah.
And this has never happened before. When the movie ended, we just sat there in silence and we just couldn't speak.
Ugh, so good.
We looked at each other and we were speechless. That experience of watching that film in a cinema when it came out, it was like it felt like something had changed. Your world had changed a little bit. And this is the magic of movies. Every now and then a movie comes along and you feel like it has opened a new channel in you, in your emotionally. And you, when you leave the theater, you're slightly different.
If anyone listening has not seen the trilogy Red, Red, White, and Blue by Krzysztof Kieślowski, you have to watch them. They are masterpieces. They really are. And Double Life of Veronique. I love Double Life of Veronique. The one right, he did right before the trilogy was amazing. And now, where can people find you and find out more about what you're doing?
I do a lot of aerial photography, helicopter photography. You can find that on IcelandGoneWild.com. My film company, RTO Films, ARTIOfilms.com. And if you look up my name on Google, you'll find my website, JohnGustafsson.com.
John, I appreciate you being on the show, you telling us your amazing adventures battling the gods in Iceland. And I cannot recommend the movie enough, Wrath of Gods, for everybody listening. If you're a filmmaker, you have to watch it. You have to watch it. So thank you, my friend.
Alex, thank you. Thank you for the podcast and everything you do. It really serves a purpose. It is especially in COVID times, it is giving all of us filmmakers that are sort of stuck around the world a community. It feels like you are a center point for that indie community that I cannot go and meet in Berlin or Cannes. Mm-hmm. So it's very valuable what you're doing, and incredible interviews. So thank you, and
that means a lot to me. So thank you so much. I appreciate that very, very much, my friend. Be well and stay safe. I want to thank Jan for coming on the show and sharing his insane story about the making of Beowulf and Grendel, and that he actually captured all of this on film. So it's not just some sort of mythical story you hear about, but you can actually see it for yourself. Now, if you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to watch, you can either rent or watch it as part of your membership to Indie Film Hustle TV. All you have to do is head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/439. And guys, if you haven't already, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com and leave a good review for the show. It really, really helps us out a lot. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.